I'm going to pray, and I do. I'm going to introduce the very first part. Rick, do you mind closing that door back there? Thanks, Rick. Okay, Father, thank you for bringing us together again. I pray that you would allow us to hear from you and just teach us. We're all in different places, struggling with different things, so I pray that you allow these words to just fall on our hearts in the ways we need to hear. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so this is my first attempt on this class to share, to co-teach with Greg. And just do me a favor, because he's not here, like, have scowls on your face when he's up here. Just shake your head a lot and do this stuff. And then when I'm up, just smile and nod your head. I'm going to use the board, and we're going to refer to this on a couple of occasions. This is something, if you've been to a How People Change class, or if you've been involved in anything with Soul Care, you've probably heard this. This is another way to reframe a lot of what goes on in the human heart and in our lives, and it's from Jeremiah 17. It's on the front of your notes. There's just an image that you can take some notes around it if you'd like, but we're going to give ourselves the freedom to refer to this, okay? But let me read the passage. Jeremiah says, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He's like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness in an uninhabited salt land. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. He's like a tree planted by streams of water that sends its roots by the stream and does not fear when heat comes, for its leaves remain green and is not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds." So this image here is... really, you can kind of capture what goes on in a fallen world based on what you're trusting in, like what's coming out of you. So the heat is a character in Jeremiah 17. The heat represents all that comes at us in a fallen world, good, bad, and ugly. The challenges, the suffering, the different things. It could even be I struggle with fatigue. If I struggle with fatigue, that's my heat. Or if I've got kids that aren't listening to me, or I get a promotion, good, bad, and ugly, that's heat. And it hits us no matter what we're trusting in. The difference between these two, I'd say two trees, but that's a bush. So the difference between these two botanical entities is that they're trusting. One's trusting in man and flesh, and the other one's trusting in the Lord. And so the man who's trusting in man is cursed. To the extent that he's not relying on the Lord, hoping in the Lord, glorifying him, he's not trusting in him, he's going to look like a bush in the wasteland that is suffering. It's relying on rain in the desert. It might come, and even when it comes, it won't see any good come, according to verse 6. It won't acknowledge it or feel it. It's just kind of like water off a duck's back. It's not going to be satisfied, because it's trusting in something other than something refreshing and satisfying. And what's coming out of this, and this is not mentioned in Jeremiah 17, but what's coming out of this bush are thorns, most likely, or bad fruits. And so this could be the sinful responses to the environment that we live in. So if you're trusting in success at work and your boss is kind of not acknowledging the work you've done, then maybe you're going to get angry or you have self-pity. What's coming out of you is going to be ugly in some form. And but this guy, I think these are both in the same environment, because this tree doesn't fear a year of drought. I mean, that sounds like a desert to me. That they're both in a harsh environment, but his hope is that he's near a stream of water, and he is, I think it sounds like he's intentionally sending his roots out by the stream. He's placing his trust in the Lord. It makes me wonder if this guy is able to do the same thing and send his roots out by the stream as well. But so you got the heart that's trusting in the Lord, and when you do, you are getting nourishment no matter what's going on, whether your kids start listening to you or not, whether your boss acknowledges you or not. If whatever it might be, you're going to produce good fruit. Couple observations, the thorns hurt others to protect self. Fruit blesses others to no particular benefit to the tree. But what's coming out of you is like the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, all that. So you don't have to try to make this good fruit. It comes out of you naturally when you are actually trusting in the Lord. And you will respond to the same situations with love, joy, peace, and patience. Okay, so to tie this to the emotions, the stuff that's coming out of us, our emotions, they can be healthy and unhealthy. So if, let's say, these guys are both facing the same situation, they both lose their job, that should produce sadness, maybe. I mean, if you enjoyed your job, you should be sad. Both of these guys can experience sadness. Sadness is not a thorn. It's an emotion. But if your hope is in your job, ultimately, then what do you do with that? You're devastated. What you were building your life on has been taken away, and it's going to have a different impact. You're going to have sadness in a different form. But if your hope is in the Lord, you could still be sad. But the toxicity of that sadness is, it's more likely to be a healthy sadness, an appropriate sadness. And so emotions are not the problem, but they are an outworking of the way we relate to and respond to our environment. Greg, you've got a microphone right there, and I'm gonna turn this over to you, but I want us to be able to refer to this, because this is this applies in a lot of situations. I can refer to it when we're talking about anger later. Yeah, go ahead. And Greg Cook is going to speak on the first half of this, on sadness and depression. And do you want to add any comments to this? Because I tried to do a quick version. It's on.
Yeah, we'll probably come back to that.
Okay, good, yeah. Good.
And if I forget and I start moving this microphone, let's trade the love. And okay. Have you started the recording, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Welcome. I recognize most of the faces in here, but not all of them. And my particular style when I'm presenting is to invite questions. I know that in the area of depression, or as Ryan referred to it, I think very appropriately, sadness, we're going to talk about depression and both some of its forms, but just to look at a couple of definitions. There's a definition at the top of your sheet. And so let me refer to that one. John Henderson, I consider him a dear friend, but he's also written a book called Equipped to Counsel, and we've used that a lot in some of our trainings. So let me challenge at least, can I offer this as a biblical definition of depression? It's a human heart condition expressed in thinking, feeling, or behaving that's regretful of the past, helpless in the present, and hopeless about the future. We can also think of it as a way of perceiving and living that is rooted in self-concern, self-pity, and frustrated desires for pleasure and preservation. So if I was going to adjust this, I would put a couple of things at the bottom here. Let me suggest to you that out of a heart that's on this place, and Ryan already talked about the self-preservation tendencies of thorns. Just preservation, you're not going to be able to read this. My wife can't even read my writing after 35 years. But and preservation and, gosh, pleasures. Let me offer some alternatives to think about that. In general, some other forms, fear, which again is about preservation, right? You're trying to preserve something that if you lose it, will absolutely devastate you. So a lot of us live in various forms of fear that are really self-preserving kinds of things. We don't want to lose something critical or precious. And then the sense of preservation, I think, or pleasures rather, we can think of that in a broad category of lust. And what I mean by lust is we're always chasing after something we don't yet have that if we could get would bring complete satisfaction, or can I say with a little s, salvation. So those are the kinds of things that are naturally driving us in that natural man heart, which is, you know, on the right side there. But its ultimate destination is going to provide or lead us to a place of despondency or depression. So what comes out of our natural heart is a sense of wanting something that we don't yet have. What comes out of our natural heart is living in fear that we're going to lose something that's very precious to us. Now contrast that with the other side of the diagram, and as Ryan read and we looked at Jeremiah 17, here's a man whose trust is not just in the Lord, but is the Lord, according to the ESV. So if the Lord is our trust, can we lose him? No, hasn't he covenanted and promised to us that he'll never leave us nor forsake us? And he's also committed to us to be the greatest source of joy. And if the Lord is our joy, then what does that say about the presence of joy in our lives? That even if we, for example, lose a job, can we still be joyful? And in the midst of that joy and abiding, can we still provide spiritual nourishment and fruit to other people? Because a spiritual fruit that Paul identifies in Galatians 5 is for the benefit of others. It's not just for our benefit, but we need to be loving for the sake of others. Even joyful, can I say, for the sake of others, that our joy should lead others to find joy in the Lord. So big picture, definition. Now, I think I'd be remiss to not only add something, but not all intense sadness or even dissatisfaction with life or even distorted perceptions are necessarily depression. Okay? If you've taken relational wisdom, and if not, I encourage you to. One of the things we address when we talk about that is that we all have distortions. We have distortions about ourselves. Our identity is not as rooted in God as we hoped it would be, and we know that's the case when circumstances of our lives disrupt us profoundly, cause us to even question who we are, what we're like. We also have distortions about God. We're born into that. When we come into this world, we either don't think of God or we only think of him in very distorted, maligned kind of ways that I think we get largely from the evil one, whose intention is to distort who God is and what he's like, to encourage us to abandon him altogether. We also have distortions about others. And these three categories, I think we're always going to fight. And the process of sanctification is, I hope, that we would think more of ourselves as the scriptures encourage us to. Think of ourselves differently, especially because of what Jesus has done. My own story includes a history of depression. And so I want to say that at the outset, that many of these ideas and thoughts not only come from many years of talking with people about their depression and reading about it and reading in the scriptures as well, but I think that phrase that Ryan referred to in verse 6, not see any good come, is probably my most succinct little definition for depression, if I can say that. And that's what resonated with me. When I read Jeremiah 17 and I see that the man who is cursed also doesn't see any good come, or as the NIV puts it, and many translations translate a little bit differently, does anybody have the NIV open? Not see prosperity when it comes. Thanks. Not see prosperity when it comes. It could be that the Lord has given all of us a great deal of prosperity, but for those who've turned away from the Lord, whose heart is turned away, whose self-confidence, self-preserving, self-producing in some sense, they're not going to see the prosperity the Lord offers, even though it has come. I think we can say that in our context. Jeremiah's context was something forthcoming, the Messiah. For us, we look back, the Messiah has come. He's the hope for all of us. Right? Let me offer, now this is a little bit dated, DSM-4 and the following DSM-4-TR were prominent when I was getting my training. And so I thought I'd show you, maybe some of you have seen this, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is what the DSM's short for. That's a mouthful. Lists a number of different symptoms typically when it's considering whether or not a person is classified in this way or another way. And for depression, here's the 9 categories. Depressed mood most of the day would have to be only 6 of these have to be present. A person may not feel depressed all the day, but what if there are diminished interest or pleasure in almost all activities? What if there's a significant weight loss or gain? What if there's insomnia or hypersomnia? What if there's psychomotor agitation or retardation? This is sort of a person isn't moving very fast. A depressed person just slows down. Even their whole body, in some sense, slows down. Great fatigue or loss of energy, feelings of worthlessness or excessive inappropriate guilt, diminished ability to think or concentrate, indecisiveness, and recurrent thoughts of death, suicidal ideation without a specific plan. Now, there are other forms of depression, but this is the classic sort of one that if you go to a therapist who's got a license with the state of Texas, and you present or describe many of these, in fact, if you describe 6 or more over what a prolonged period of life would be, or a prolonged period would be 2 weeks or more, that these are present, then they're going to classify you as depressed. But I want to show you this not to spend a lot of time with it, but to let you know that it used to be, even before these came up, that depression as a clinical diagnosis was diagnosed when somebody felt a great deal of these, but there was no circumstantial connection to it. If a person, for example, had lost a spouse of many years, or even a few years, and they came and presented these kinds of responses to a therapist, the therapist wouldn't necessarily have classified them as clinically depressed. In fact, shouldn't have classified them. There's nothing disordered about that. That's the normal order of things. So for us to have experienced sadness in our life, which is common, all of us have been, to one extent or another, depressed. And I hope as you see through this list, you can say, well, check that off the list. Yeah, sure, I can relate to that. And so I want to present a biblical definition with John's, suggesting that as we think biblically about pervasive sadness and feeling overwhelmed, we want to see it as at least incorporating a heart issue. And what our culture's told us now for many decades is that depression's primarily a brain chemistry problem. Right? We've all of a sudden discovered that it's a brain chemistry problem, and so if, you know, 1,000 years ago we had Prozac, then we wouldn't have depression, right? Here's the interesting thing. Now that you start to talk about depression very openly, guess what the incidence of depression has done now that we've defined it a little more carefully? Shot up. How many of you have felt depressed? And if you talk to therapists, they'll tell you that all of us at some point or another, and maybe as many as 25% of us have some kind of mental disorder at any given time. But if it's strictly biological and physiological, why is depression on the rise now that we've created these medications to help us? Right? Well, I want to suggest that it's maybe a little more complex than just a physiological problem. If you yourself have struggled with depression, you've probably known that the first medication you got or the first dosage you got was probably likely insufficient. And if it helped you for a while, if you've been on it for a long time, guess what? Time to reevaluate. Right? So I want to expand the idea of depression to be way beyond just our biochemistry, our neural activity, whether or not we've got the right endorphins passing through our neurons or not. Okay. So how do we respond to depression? So a couple of things. I show the DSM. There are some people who are chronically depressed, And I would say I'm probably in that category. Not depressed to the point of suicidality by any stretch of imagination, although you should know, that don't know me, I attempted suicide in college. So this is a real thing. And my mom was profoundly affected by depression her entire life, was hospitalized numerous times, one time for 8 months, in which there was real serious question about whether she should ever come out of that institution. And attempted suicide and was really pervasively suicidal until the day of her death, which was now 8 years ago. It wasn't depression, but it was cancer, but yeah.
As you move through this list on responding to depression, how much of it is going to apply to just simply responding to sadness, yeah, and grief, and other things?
So that's, thank you, Ryan. That's part of what I was wanting to say. Let me suggest for a few people, and the national average is something, I think around 4 to 5%, and it depends on whether you're female, whether you're young, whether you're older, et cetera. There are some people who are born with a tendency toward, well, we use an old term, melancholy. Toward seeing just a little bit, life was a little bit more hard. Maybe they're especially introverted. Maybe they're drained easily by being around a lot of people. I'll tell you a couple of theologians and outstanding pastors that you may have heard before, Jonathan Edwards and Charles Spurgeon. There are many others, but those are the names you'd probably all of us in this room would recognize. Do you know they struggled profoundly with depression whole life? Now, that did not keep them from being fruitful. So some people, a few, might have depression as part of their heat, but I would say 95% or better than that of us, when depression comes up, it's going to come up largely in this arena as a reaction to life that we didn't care for, and it leads us to a sense of hopelessness. That most of it is probably, I don't know that we even have 100 people, so maybe there's not more than a couple of people who struggle with this pervasive sense of depression. But whether it's part of your heat or part of your thorns can be probably evaluated and even responded to with the following list of things. And I want to not dismiss the idea that depression is at least in large part up here for us. It's a way of seeing or perceiving. It's a way of looking at life. It's having recurring thoughts that lead us to a place of desperation, hopelessness. So to address depression without addressing your mind seems foolish to me. What are some of the ways the Bible invites us to look at how we think? Well, of course, Romans 12, 1 and 2 talk about this necessity for renewing our minds. And in fact, apart from renewing our minds, we really won't know what the will of God is for us, will we? God wouldn't have given us propositional truth, stories, understanding that can come from here unless we had to have our minds changed. First, about who God is. I mean, that's the most fundamental thing. Who do you say God is? Who do we say Jesus is? That's the first place to address it. If it's been a chronic problem and the person doesn't know Christ, I think that's the biggest first necessity for us. We're supposed to set our minds on truth. There's lots of different ways we can think about that. In Philippians 4, Paul says, now this isn't the context of anxiety, but I'm frankly torn. I don't know too many people who struggle with anxiety that don't also slip into depression from time to time, or vice versa. The reason we're talking about these toxic emotions, these are the ones that we all face. We all face excessive sadness and pervasive sadness sometimes. We all face anxiety or anger, as Ryan will get to in a few minutes. So we got to set our minds on truth. And Paul says, finally, brethren, whatever is right, true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, of good repute, there's anything excellent, anything worthy of praise, set your mind on these things. And if we set our mind on any one of those, much less all of them, it'll drive us to considering God more than ourselves. And that's a good thing. I think without drawing God into the picture of our minds, depression will not leave. It may leave temporarily. It may leave because a circumstance gets changed. If that loss of job creates this despondency in us, but the next morning that person wakes up and hears they've got another job, then the despondency goes away. But is it prone to return? I think emphatically yes. Yeah. It'll just be a different circumstance next time. It's interesting when you talk to a person, and I don't want to be glib about this, but I do talk to a number of people who get to the place of not only sadness, but suicidal hopelessness. There's almost in every single time. It's not the same thing every time. I can talk to a man who's lost his wife, and he can be suicidal. But another man who lost his wife doesn't create this profound depression, but if he loses his job, that creates a circumstance. So whatever would make life no longer worth living can be actually a source of our depression. Or to put it differently, our idols promise us life when they can't deliver on that promise. If a person's made an idol of their jobs and they lose their jobs, they lose any sense of purpose for living.
I would add that that's why God is often good in taking those things away. They make lousy save. They're unable to save. And if in Romans 1, it says his judgment is to give people what they want, turn them over to their desires, and never really intervene anymore. Yeah. And so that's often his intervention to take our eyes off of a false promise.
So he's not just making us miserable for miserable sake, huh? You know, I think it is God's kindness to present to us and to reveal to us where our hearts and our hopes really lie. I don't know how many are you familiar with Martin Lloyd-Jones' Spiritual Depression. It's a book that came out, I think, in 65, or a series of sermons that were presented in 65 and then eventually became a book form. But I've enjoyed and been challenged by thinking through this, and I think it was, well, that's the earliest I know of somebody suggesting this next statement, that we need to stop listening to ourselves and we need to start speaking to ourselves. And the verse that's at the top of the page here in Psalm 42 is a great example. And I list three verses because between Psalm 42 and 43, three times this very exact repetition verse, and some think that this shouldn't have been divided into two psalms, but one. This is the refrain, "Why are you downcast, O my soul? And why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my salvation and my God." You see how the psalmist David here is speaking to himself? He's in a depressed place. He's downcast. His soul is downcast. So how does he remedy that? He begins to remember who God is. He begins to speak to himself truth. And if you've ever struggled with depression, you know that whether it came from a friend or whether you went there finally and put yourself before the scriptures, the scriptures have an amazing ability to lift our eyes off of a horizon, off of a focus, or more likely, off of a self-preoccupation. I've sometimes described depression as being in a funny house of a world of mirrors. I've been to many of those, but you know, if you've ever gone through a hall of mirrors and there's all kinds of distortions, but what's the common denominator? Everywhere you turn, all you can see is yourself. You'll see a distorted image of yourself, but it's sort of a scary experience, right? And what if you couldn't get out of that hall? What if you couldn't get out of those mirrors? That's what severe depression feels like. Everywhere I turn, I can see myself, and I don't know any way out of this. I tell you that not only because some of you can immediately relate, having gone through that, but also some people have a harder time identifying with depression because it's not been part of their struggle, but something like anger or fear might have been. So I want to increase your understanding so that if you know, or as you know, people who struggle with this, hopefully you can minister to them, or at least increase your understanding of what they're going through. And compassion. Third, acknowledge that you're not God and do not have his incommunicable attributes. What do I mean by that? Incommunicable may be a term you've heard, but it just refers to those attributes of God that though we are made in God's image, he doesn't give us every bit of himself and every ability he has. So things like foreknowledge, we don't have. Now, there's lots of prophets that will tell us and give us hope for what's to come, but we ultimately don't know what tomorrow brings. And yet, I live my life sometimes with a fury of trying to guard it and control it in such a way that I can predict what's going to happen, I can plan for it, I can fill my planner up with all kinds of things. And guess what happens when interruptions come into my life? A confusion of anger and sometimes anxiety and sometimes even depression. Because I lust after what God alone has, the knowledge of knowing what's going to happen. That happens to be a peculiar trigger for me in my depressions, is either realizing I've made a profound mistake and I regret and overwhelm about it, or I can't figure out the future and therefore I'm afraid of it and hopeless because I don't think I can control what's going to happen. And frankly, guess what? I can't control what's going to happen. And neither can you. I also don't have omniscience. I don't know everything. And there's a peculiar stubbornness in the mind of a depressed person who declares, I know everything and I know the future is going to be terrible, and so they stop. But they're somewhat declaring to themselves an incommunicable attribute, I know everything. I see everything. Or some of it might be triggered by control. I can control everything, and guess what? When you realize, and you will quickly, maybe stubbornly, you won't realize it for a while, I can't control what's going to happen. But if we can't, really, we need God's help to have the experience of self-control. That's a Holy Spirit-derived ability that doesn't come to us naturally, right? So you can think of all kinds of incommunicable attributes, and I think we need to repent. So when Psalm 51:4 says, against thee and thee only have I sinned, and we looked at that even last week, right? This is what I think David's pointing us to, is I've got to stop wanting to be God. I've got to let God be God. I've got to trust in him and not myself anymore.
Psalm 131 is a great
brief
picture of that, by the way.
Yeah, I have calmed and quieted my soul. Like a weaned child with his mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is how we learn to do that. We need spiritual help, supernatural help to do this, by the way. Secondly, submit your will to God's plan. Depression thrives in a battle of the wills. But when we submit to God, it's no longer about our plans, our approaches to life. It's about submitting, trusting that the Father who is infinitely good, infinitely loving, infinitely present, infinitely wise, infinitely understanding, absolutely in control of everything that's going to happen from here on out. When we entrust ourselves to him, if this is part of his will, if this is what he has for me, then I submit to that and I trust this is good. I can declare it good just because Paul alone in Romans 8:28 says it's good. Now, that takes faith. It takes faith that moves beyond what we can see to trust the unseen. Hope that is seen is not hope at all. And yet the hopelessness that we find is because we've objectified, we've said this is what's going to happen, and we're hopeless because we're seeing what's going to happen, as though we can. Yeah. Fellowship with others. This is worship is something we do willfully. It's not something that happens to us. It's something we decide to do. You made a decision to come to church today, and worshiping may not be your highest priority, or you might realize it once you're in there, but you have moved your body from your bed to this place, at least this far along. You will yourself to worship. So coming and fellowshipping with others, even when you don't feel like it, it's a tremendous act of faith, but it's also an act of your will. And sometimes our will gets submitted to our emotions, and our emotions decide what our will is going to do rather than our minds. And I'm pushing against that. Repent and confess. I've already touched a little bit on that, but there are some people who struggle pervasively with depression. And at least here's one of the themes that I hear sometimes, I can't forgive myself. there's something I did or something that was done to me that I just can't get over. But it screams at the same time, the cross was not sufficient. What Jesus did was not enough. There's something I have to do or something I need to do in order to fulfill what Jesus only partially accomplished. Well, we know that's, at least theologically, that's a lie. We've got to acknowledge that and say, Lord, I've been thinking wrongly about this for a long time. Agree with the Lord that you're thinking wrongly about that. That's what confession is, agreeing with him. Repentance, let me turn my mind toward you, away from myself. Turn my mind on you rather than on my circumstance. I think that people fear the future who don't see enough of the future in front of them. Because what does the Bible provide for us? It shows us what's ultimately true. We're not looking far enough into the future if we're frustrated about it. We're just simply not looking far enough away. Because God has declared he will return, he will be with us, he will conquer, and we'll be forever with him, and we'll be like him when we see him. Now set your mind on those things, and I challenge you to continue to be depressed when you look at the promises of what God's provided. Be thankful anyway. This is an act of the will, actually, to be thankful. We're commanded to, in all things, oh, thank you.
No, oh. I'm afraid the whole time I might have been recording the music on the computer.
Yeah. Do we need to set anything? Okay.
Just start over.
Yeah, I'm already probably past my time here. Be thankful anyway. Some people languish over the question of what's God's will for my life. That can send, that unanswered question can send some people into a form of sadness. I just don't know what God's will is for me.
Well, it's interesting that Philippians 4, 6, and 7 tells you, you know, to give thanks as you're praying. It's almost directing with your mouth, it's directing your heart by will, you know, to say, even though I don't feel it yet, I'm going to thank you for what you're doing. And it's claiming by faith.
That's
but
right.
A little exercise I've sometimes done with the alphabet. If I, you know, think of something that starts with A, thank God for, you know, adoption. Thank God for Brandy. Thank God for, and I thank him. And usually when I get to, if I'm struggling with self-pity, I'm usually in tears by the time I get to F.
Yeah. You know. It's absolutely true. Try it. If you don't believe me. Try it. Begin to be thankful. It's impossible to stay hopeless and thankful at the same time. But if you're not thankful, you're not in God's will, right? At least according to Paul in Thessalonians. Allow your emotions to be changed, but don't insist that they must change. I know I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. Think of it this way. I sometimes think in terms of my rights. Sometimes our rights get us into a lot of trouble, and we're a very rights-oriented society and culture, aren't we? I often take those rights in the form of prayers that seem more like demands on God, entitlements, and I say, Lord, deliver me from my depression. And maybe I still have a sense of pervasive sadness. Do I have the right to demand that God takes that sort of undercurrent of sadness away from me? So I might say, Lord, I give up the right to be free from this. I just want you to be with me in it and guide me. Fill me with your spirit that what comes out of me in spite of this is something different, something that would give you glory and honor. But there's another kind of right. There are some people who hang tenaciously onto the right to be depressed. Depression, as awful as it is, really is a great advantage to a lot of people. What do you think I mean by that? Well, I'm thinking more of the negative part of it, Sally. Maybe this people who could let go of their depression but won't, why wouldn't they? It's an excuse to be less productive. For some people, look, depression relieves us of all responsibilities, right? All we have to do is say, well, it's this depression that's causing me to not do anything. I can't do anything because of my depression. But it also, so that's excellent. Another thought? Scapegoat, okay. It gives you an out.
It keeps me from confessing my sin.
May keep you from confessing your sin, okay. I know one of the components of my depression is, guess how people treat a depressed person? Boy, it gives me a lot of attention and sympathy, doesn't it? I sort of crave sympathy. I love people being concerned about me. I love that when they see me, they ask me, so how are you doing, Greg? I mean, but that can go too far, can't it? Because I can be more concerned in my conversations with people about how is Greg doing than how about how wonderful Jesus is. Do we ever take, does a depressed person ever allow the conversation to go with the wonder and the fascination with the beauty and the majesty of Christ? Because when it does, my perspective shifts. But some people will not give up the right to be depressed. It's doing too much for them. So I don't want to say that's categorically true for everybody. Please understand. I'm just saying, but I give up the right to be depressed. I give up the right to not be depressed if I'm submitting my will to the Lord. It's up to you, Lord. You know what's best. You know the perfect teaching plan for me. You know the perfect lesson plans. You know exactly what I need. If you're going to progress me from somebody who's self-preoccupied to somebody who becomes Jesus preoccupied, that's the big plan, right? That we move from it's only about me to it's only about Jesus. And that's what sanctification, when it's fully accomplished, looks like. That's when we see Jesus, we'll be like him, because finally we'll know why he deserves all glory, honor, worship, praise. Yeah. Yeah, but don't insist.
Because in the context of like depression or guilt or fear or anger, I know I struggle with sticky emotions, like I can pray and it doesn't go away. And I feel like our instant conclusion is something's wrong with God, like he's not powerful enough to do it, or didn't do it for me, so he's not doing this genie thing I want to do, or there's something wrong with my prayer, there's not enough faith. And I have found that neither of those are true, but what's helpful sometimes is just to lay it down or pray about it and then distract, go do something else, but just to do the next right thing.
Just to stay
there and wait for a feeling, because we're going to draw all kinds of wrong conclusions that way.
Thank you for saying that. It's exactly right. I think, again, when this starts to worm its way into our identity and now we re-identify ourselves, we're essentially a depressed person, or we're essentially emotional. I counseled a guy in, again, different category, but when trying to address his anger, he says, well, I can't help it. I'm Italian, and I'm a passionate person. And he was dead serious. Dead serious, as though God couldn't change anything about the fact that he was born or his ancestry was from a particular place. You see how much we identify with that, even beyond the reality of being born again, which gives us a brand new identity. The old things have passed away. Do we accept God to chase us? I'm sorry I'm taking so long. Let me run through the rest of these. And I think what Ryan has to say about anger, you can see some parallels because we're talking again. You're going to see some parallels as we talk about all these common toxic emotions. The responses to those are very similar. Relinquish your past to Christ's work of freeing us from it. Some people get depressed again because of their past. Unconfessed sin haunts and hinders. It's a repetition, but it really can. If we don't confess it, it will affect us, maybe not spiritually, but it can affect where our mind goes. And it can affect whether or not we're going to be faithful to serve others and to be with others and to take our minds away from celebrate your weakness. 2 Corinthians 12:10 says, therefore I'm content. Paul gives this top list of contentments, And I challenge you to find the same list in your life, because you probably got a lot of bucket list items. What would give you contentment, satisfaction? Paul's is weakness. I'm well content with weakness, with afflictions. Sorry, I've got too many versions in my mind. But he goes on to list things like persecutions and difficult circumstances is what he finds his contentment in. In fact, he says, well content. This is, I think, goes back to Philippians. I've learned to be content in whatever circumstance that I am, with much or with little. Now, how free would you guys be if you were free from having to have your condition of contentment be in a circumstance? Do you want full freedom? Then no longer be conditioned by your circumstances. Be content with the person and the work of Jesus, which is especially seen when we know we can't, when our weakness has surfaced yet again. And how will he get the most glory if he's not doing all of the work? I'll confess to you, and don't share it with anybody else, but it's probably abundantly obvious. When I walk into that pulpit, it's an intimidating thing to think that you're representing the Lord and saying, thus say the Lord. I feel incredibly weak. And if the God has used me in any of those circumstances, it's because he's got to be the one holding me up during that whole time and speaking through me. Or else I realize it'll be of no consequence to anybody. So I rejoice in my weakness. And please do that. Even if depression or sadness is one of your weaknesses, glory in it. Rejoice in it. Allow the God to show his strength in that. I'm so encouraged. Some people, believe it or not, forced by will to come to church every morning, every Sunday morning, and they don't feel like it. Others don't feel like getting out of bed, but they move their legs and arms and body out of bed. Can I suggest to you that's that first act of worship in the morning? Now, others look forward to getting up, and they get up before their alarm does, and it's not necessarily an act of worship. It may be an act of self-proclamation for other people. But for some, it's a great act of worship. Do you know you can worship the Lord by going against your will and according to his truth, according to what would give him the most glory? Use your body to fight depression rather than submitting to it. And that's the first point. Hold your Bible and use your eyes. You know, I have to use my body to get my Bible positioned, and then I have to use my Bible, my body, to read the book. Those are acts of my body. So I can will my body to do things my emotions may not feel like doing. We all can do that, and listen intentionally. Use your ears to listen to another voice, to listen to something new, something that's not so rehearsed and so pervasive in your mind. Walk, eat, and go outside. I do not want to deny or suggest that there's often a somatic or a bodily involvement in some of these things. And it's incredibly helpful to walk, to move, when your emotions tell you stay still, curl up like a fetal position and don't go anywhere. But use your body to do that. Will your body to do that. It may not feel right, but I think this is a complex thing. I think most of what we try and do with biblical counseling, and I'll turn it over real quick, but it's not just one thing or another. That's the simplification. Maybe we can sort of look to the medical community in some ways that suggests routinely that there's got to be one missing ingredient, one thing we can do, and if we do that one thing, then everything will be fine. Stop looking for one thing. This is probably going to be multiple things, because I think we are a more complex being than just a mind, or just a body, or just a spirit, or just a will, or just emotions. Emotions are good things. We're not maligning emotions, but when one thing begins to dictate everything else, and it's not God, then we know something's awry. Fight for joy and for the joy of others. We are created to be joyful. We're commanded to it. I think joy can be found in the midst of all kinds of circumstances, and I'm indebted to the work of John Piper, for one, who's helped me to see the preeminence of joy as we go through life. So, thanks.
I'll take your log if you want.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
I think this is a good example of me packing too much luggage into one suitcase.
Well, I didn't help.
Oh. I'm not too concerned about hitting all of anger, honestly. I use anger as my default illustration or, you know, example, because it's probably the one I most closely I struggle with. So does anybody have any questions for Greg? Before? Yes.
Yeah, so the question was, what about genes? What if it's in your family? Again, I look at, well, I'll use my own family, for example. Clearly, there was something genetic that profoundly affected my mom. I'm the only known sibling among my siblings that's not an antidepressant. My father's on an antidepressant. Now, whether it's genetic with him or not, I don't know. But why am I not on an antidepressant now? And I want to be careful. This is my story and not others. But at least in my case, adopting an approach to life that includes these things can, I think, mitigate against genes. The genes don't have the final say. They influence, but they don't determine. So I think each of us are influenced by many different things, but I don't think our body determines what we do or how we think, but it may make it harder. That's where I started to say, I see greater faith in a person who struggles to get to church because of their sadness than somebody who's looking forward to it. So I'm often encouraged by those who struggle with pervasive challenges.
I think that's what made Martin Lloyd-Jones, Charles Spurgeon, Jonathan Edwards, John Piper to an extent, such powerful preachers. Is they are proclaiming these truths despite their feelings naturally. So it's I pointed to the heat because I think it's the heat is the cards dealt to us sovereignly by God. And what do we make of that? And then sometimes it can get, it's complex though, because then we can sinfully respond to that situation. What came first? It becomes confusing. But yeah, good question. Cliff. I don't think there's a simple answer to that.
No, but I would at least suggest that look at your joys and honestly ask the question, and I would think praying along the lines of Psalm 139, 23, 24, Lord, search my heart, see if there's any hurtful way in me. But I often use the question, where's your joy set up? What's going to give you joy? If you don't have joy, then it's because you either don't know the Lord or you're not finding your joy in Him. If you're in the Lord and your joy is someplace else besides the Lord, then it's most likely a thorn, not part of your heat. But either way, the response list that I've offered will address either of those. Whether it's part of the heart or part of the thorns, responding to it differently. And if there's nothing to repent of, finding joy in something else or your circumstance, then maybe it is more the heat.
Okay, so we're going to continue by talking about anger. And I'm going to let you know that I'm speaking this in the privacy of my office. We had a technical difficulty and lost the second half of the recording. So just understand that if you don't hear, if it seems really quiet, you hear other noises, it's me in my office just talking into my phone. Okay, so having said that, let's talk about anger.
just going to walk through your notes here. To understand anger, a lot of my personal illustrations that I've been using so far in the class, a lot of them revolve around anger. That's probably where I've struggled the most. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on anger because I feel like I've already spent a lot of time talking about anger. But let me break it down by just first defining anger. And it says this in your notes, but anger is a response to a perceived wrong. Anger always says that is wrong. That's where it starts. And what it is essentially it's a destructive energy released in defense of something you love. So it's an outworking of love. When you love your downtime, you know, I like my me time, and then I get in a traffic jam on the way home and I'm not going to have as much time to myself, I might get angry at the traffic, when the truth is, like, what I'm loving is the time I get to have at home watching Netflix. That's just a random example. But anger is always a destructive energy that is destroying something that threatens what you love. When you love a person dying of cancer, for example, you hate and are angry at the cancer that's destroying them, so you release a destructive energy called chemotherapy. And that's kind of, I think chemotherapy is a good picture of anger. It's a destructive energy designed to kill what's killing the thing that you love, or the one that you love. Okay, so next point on your understanding anger section is that anger is not necessarily sinful. Ephesians 4:26 says, in your anger do not sin. And there's other areas that can make this case, but anger in and of itself is not sinful. God is angry. I mean, you see a lot of scriptures that make that point. And when Jesus gets angry and turns over tables, he's not in sin. His anger is a proper response that something truly good that he loves, the glory of God, is being threatened in the temple by turning a place of worship into a place to buy and sell. Jesus, in his anger, his love for his Father's glory leads him to destroy what's threatening his Father's glory. That's anger that's not sinful. I've got a little chart to the right of this on your handouts, and just comparing God's anger. God's anger is always righteous, but man's anger is almost always unrighteous. I mean, I think I can think of one or two times in my life where my anger has been what I felt like was almost was righteous, because I could sense the Holy Spirit moving in my heart at that moment. I don't have time to go into every detail that comes to my mind. But here's the next one. God's anger on the chart is an expression of his love. Man's anger is always an expression of our disordered love. God's anger is a settled opposition to evil, while man's anger is an opposition to anything that threatens my agenda. But when I say God's anger is a settled opposition to evil, sometimes I find with my anger is that I might learn to control my anger in the moment, but then what might happen is I never return to deal with the issue. So if my son is defiant, I might get angry in the moment, but I realize, well, I'm going to just react, and that won't be healthy, so I will deal with it later, and then my son, everything passes, and then I find that, oh, I could bring that back up, but it's just too difficult. That is not a settled opposition to evil. That is a fickle commitment to maybe peace, you know, that I don't want to rock the boat and bring up a difficult thing. That's not true anger that is righteous. Doesn't it moves slowly, and it doesn't forget to attack the real problem. I hope these explanations are helpful. God's anger, the next thing on the chart, is always under control. He's never bossed around by his anger. Us, though, our anger is usually out of control. God's anger is slow anger. Ours, man's anger, we have outbursts when that's quick anger, or we stuff it, in which it just simply turns into something more ugly or deadly. Or even worse off is having no anger at all. Not being angry is truly a toxic lack of emotion. If you aren't angry at the, if my son's being defiant, going back to that, and I don't get angry, it's because I don't care about my son. If I don't care about his holiness, that is truly the opposite of love, isn't it? Not being angry is often the biggest problem. God's anger is a surgical anger, while man's anger is slashing. What does that mean? Well, God's anger is surgical in that it brings life by destroying sin, while man's anger often brings death by destroying the sinner. You could, you know, in your anger, if you are reacting, it's sort of like taking out a knife and just slashing wherever, you know, that whole idea of, you know, if you're angry, you go home and you kick the dog. That's slashing. That's not attacking the problem. That's attacking whatever's near you. God's anger is not like a sword, but it's more like a scalpel that comes out and it cuts out the source of the cancer. It cuts out the problem. And sure, it might bring pain, but it's bringing life by destroying the sin. God's anger is radically different from man's anger. And last couple things I'll say in setting this up. Anger is powerful, and it's dangerous because it's powerful. It's deceptive. It's powerful because it moves so fast with such force, and it wants results right now. It's deceptive in that nobody thinks that they're angry. Everybody thinks that, well, I mean, I actually had a class on anger, a two-week class called I'm Not Angry, I'm Just ... That was the name of the class. I'm not angry, I'm just irritated. I'm just tired. I'm just stressed. Nobody really thinks that they're angry. They just think that it's something else. And that's because I think anger is deceptive. If you look at Ephesians 4, verse 31, there are a bunch of synonyms for anger. They look like synonyms. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Those are not simply synonyms of anger. They are different types of anger. Bitterness is a below the surface, underground anger that comes out like lava when provoked. But then wrath, I believe, is could also be translated as fury, and it's the kind of anger that shows up really quickly, and then it goes away really quickly. If you suddenly get mad while you're driving, or you, that's very different than bitterness. Malice, the last thing listed in that verse, is not rooting for someone's good. It's not being for someone. It's wanting to see them pay for their sin. That's a form of unforgiveness, is malice. Anger is not simply the person with the tantrums or the person who gets angry and raises his voice. It's often the person who stuffs it and has a quiet resentment that you don't even see. We all struggle with anger. That's why I also mentioned that it's universal. Everybody has it, but nobody really knows that they have it. I mean, few people do. David Pallison has a book called Good and Angry, and in it he says, I think it's chapter 3, I think. The name of the chapter is something like, Do You Have a Problem with Anger? And the chapter has one word, and just simply says yes, and you're on to chapter 4. It's kind of a cute way of making the point that everybody has a problem with anger. It's universal. Okay, having said that, how do you deal? How do we engage anger? Well, here are your blanks. First, we have to admit our anger. Simply recognizing the varieties of anger that can come in, the various forms of anger that we might have, helps us to admit it. You know, do you grumble? Do you get negative? Are you impatient? Do you get moody, judgmental? Do you have a hard time forgiving? Do you write off relationships? Do you argue? You have self-pity, cynicism, apathy, prayerlessness. Those are all different forms of anger. So when you see anger or signs of it, admit it. And when you do that, that's an act of vulnerability. It's a step out of denial into reality, meaning you instead of denying it, you're just acknowledging reality. And by doing so, it's a mark of humility that opens you up to receiving help from others. Okay, so that's the first blank. Second blank, restrain your immediate response. Those verses listed, Proverbs 12:18, says, reckless words pierce like a sword. You know, if you just say the first thing that comes to your mind in anger, it's like stabbing a person. It's, you can't take it back. The wound is there. It does damage. A harsh word stirs up anger. The good sense makes one slow to anger. That's Proverbs 19:11. All these verses really lift up the virtue of being slow to anger or the damage of having reactive anger. But whatever the case is, when you are restraining your immediate response, you can only do that by cultivating a distrust for your instinctive responses. One thing that's deceptive about anger is that we always feel right when we're angry. Anger feels like a righteous thing every time, but we do damaging things with that feeling, right? You're becoming more wise when you cultivate a distrust of your own rightness when you react in anger. Learn to distrust yourself and slow down and think, maybe I don't have the right response right now. Restrain your immediate response. Third, analyze your anger. Locate the source of your anger. What are you wanting? What are you defending? What is it that's got you worked up? You're usually going to find that the thing that has you upset is something other than God, something other than loving others. It's something usually that's selfish on some level. Maybe there's a combination of things, but analyze your anger. And then, number four, take your anger to God. That's what we talked about in week two in a lot of detail. Express your feelings and your anger to God, no matter how toxic it seems. And as you vent, there's Psalms that can immediately come to mind. Psalm 13, Psalm 3, those are just two examples. But you hear it starts off like, you know, why are you so far from me, God? Why do you keep forgetting me? Or how long will my enemies keep tormenting me? That kind of start to a psalm, it sounds almost like he's accusing God recklessly. But you can tell David is listening to what he's saying because I'm not looking at a Bible as I'm saying this, but Psalm 3, I think it's verse 3, after venting for two verses in anger, he says, but you're a shield about me. You're my glory. You're the lifter of my head. You're good. I heard what was coming out of my mouth, and that's not the whole story. You've been good, or you haven't forgotten me, God. When we take our anger or our feelings to God, if we listen to ourselves, we need to have a skepticism of what we're saying. We say it, and we express our feeling, and we know that God is listening and caring about us, but as we're saying what we're saying in our anger, listen to yourself, and I would use the word cultivate again, cultivate a skepticism of your own sense of being right. Cultivate a skepticism of your rightness, not God's rightness. I'm saying these things, Lord. I'm angry about this. And deep down, I'm listening to myself thinking, Ryan, you know you're the one who's wrong, not God. God is right. And as you vent and you start to sense, God's listening to me right now. I say this by faith, but if you really do this, if you vent and you take your anger to God, you're going to sense God listening. He connects with us when we give our emotions to him. He's the ultimate counselor. He can listen and love us, even if we're wrong in our anger. And when you encounter him, you humble yourself. Remember his faithfulness. Trust in him. confess where you're wrong. God, I know I'm angry, but I also know I haven't been faithful to you. I've been hurting my friend with this or whatever. And you start to own what you've done, and you forgive. Yeah, if you're angry about something, you can start to wrestle with forgiving when you're taking your anger to God, and ask for His help. Okay, so you take your anger to God, no matter how toxic it is. Number five, as you connect with Him, start to consider your options. God, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do with this anger? What do you want me to do with this situation that's making me angry? You seek wisdom from God and seek it from others. You can ask yourself this question. Does what I feel like I'm being called to do with this, is what I'm considering, is it going to will it actually deal with the wrong or with the problem? Will it help the relationship? Will it deal with the thing that's making me angry? Is it best for the person that I'm angry at? And the two most constructive options are going to be either, yes, go confront the person in love in a helpful way, or you might have to consciously decide to overlook the matter that's made you angry. And I have in that little box below when you should overlook an offense. Proverbs 19:11, good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook an offense. When you can answer no to all four of the questions below, then you overlook it. The four questions being, is the offense seriously dishonoring to God? If the answer is no, then you move to the next one. Has it permanently damaged a relationship? No. Is it seriously hurting other people? No. Well, then, is it seriously hurting the offender himself? Okay, if the answer is no to all four questions, overlook it. Forget about it. If it's, my husband left his socks on the couch. He's done it a couple times, you know. He did it again. It's really annoying. I have to pick it up. He doesn't even know about it, but you know, if it's annoying, I mean, okay, is that seriously dishonor God? No. Does it permanently damage a relationship? No. Is it seriously hurting other people? I mean, maybe they smell, but let's just say no. Is it seriously hurting your husband, his socks on the couch? No. It's probably one to overlook. Now, is it a recurring pattern? Well, in love, you can say, honey, could you please put the socks away? Let me mute my computer. Okay, so that's number five. Number six, take appropriate action. I have not been looking at my notes here. Just basically, what needs to be done? You might need support. You might need prayer. You might need accountability as you move forward in response. But that's just the last step, is do something. Excuse me, do something with that. After you've taken it to God and considered your options, do it. Do what needs to be done. Week three explored this. If it comes to connecting with another person in your anger, how do you take that anger and move back toward that relationship? That's what week three was about. I hope this little summary was helpful. I'm going to send a couple other things that I didn't get to in my notes in my email, but that's it for now. I hope you have a good one. Bye.